Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for September 27, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. In the headlines today is an article on Trump legal problems called Judge Finds Years of Financial Fraud. Ruling calls for business licenses to be rescinded. A judge ruled Tuesday that Donald Trump committed fraud for years while building the real estate empire that catapulted him to fame and the White House. Judge Arthur Engoron, ruling in a civil lawsuit brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James, found that the former president and his company deceived banks, insurers, and others by massively overvaluing his assets and exaggerating his net worth on paperwork used in making deals and securing financing. Engoron ordered that some of Trump's business licenses be rescinded as punishment, making it difficult or impossible for them to do business in New York, and said he would continue to have an independent monitor oversee the Trump Organization's operation. A message seeking comment was left for a Trump spokesperson. Trump has long insisted he did nothing wrong. The decision, days before the start of a non-jury trial in James' lawsuit, is the strongest repudiation yet of Trump's carefully coiffed image as a wealthy and shrewd real estate mogul turned political powerhouse. Beyond mere bragging about his riches, Trump, his company, and key executives repeatedly lied about them on his annual financial statements, reaping rewards such as favorable loan terms and lower insurance costs, Engoron found. Those tactics crossed a line and violated the law, the judge said, rejecting Trump's contention that a disclaimer on the financial statements absolved him of any wrongdoing. In defendant's world, rent-regulated apartments are worth the same as unregulated apartments. Restricted land is worth the same as unrestricted land. Restrictions can evaporate into thin air. A disclaimer by one party casting responsibility on another party exonerates the other party's lies, Engoron wrote in his 35-page ruling. That is a false fantasy world, not the real world. Manhattan prosecutors looked into bringing criminal charges over the same conduct, but declined to do so, leaving James to sue Trump and seek penalties that aim to disrupt his and his family's ability to do business in the state. Engoron's ruling, in a phase of the case known as summary judgment, resolves the key claim in James' lawsuit, but several others remain. He'll decide on those claims and James' request for a $250 million in penalties at a trial starting Monday. Trump's lawyers ask an appeals court for a temporary delay. Trump's lawyers, in their own summary judgment bid, argued James wasn't legally allowed to file the lawsuit because there wasn't evidence that the public was harmed by Trump's actions. They also argued that many of the allegations in the lawsuit were barred by the statute of limitations. Engoron, noting that he emphatically rejected those arguments earlier in the case, he equated them to the time loop in the film Groundhog Day. With his ruling, he fined five defense lawyers $7,500 each as punishment for, quote, engaging in repetitive, frivolous, close quote, arguments, but denied James' request to sanction Trump, his two eldest sons, and other defendants. James, a Democrat, sued Trump and the Trump Organization a year ago, alleging a pattern of duplicity that she dubbed the Art of the Steal, a twist on the title of Trump's 1987 business memoir, The Art of the Deal. The lawsuit accused Trump and his company of routinely inflating the value of assets like skyscrapers, golf courses, and his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, padding his bottom line by billions. Engoron found that Trump consistently overvalued Mar-a-Lago on his financial statements between 2014 and 2021, inflating its value on one statement by 2,300%, and rebuked him for lying about the size of his Trump Tower apartment in Manhattan. Trump claimed the three-story penthouse was nearly three times its actual size, valuing the property at $327 million. A discrepancy of this order of magnitude by a real estate developer sizing up his own living space of decades can only be considered fraud, Engoron wrote. Trump has denied wrongdoing, arguing in sworn testimony for the case that the values on his financial statements didn't matter because they have a disclaimer that says they shouldn't be trusted. Trump argued that banks made a lot of money from him and didn't object to his valuations. James' lawsuit is one of several legal headaches for Trump as he campaigns for a return to the White House in 2024. He has been indicted four times in the last 6 months, accused in Georgia and Washington, D.C. of plotting to overturn his 2020 election loss, in Florida of boarding classified documents, of hoarding classified documents, and in Manhattan of falsifying business records related to hush money paid on his behalf. The Trump Organization was convicted of tax fraud last year on an unrelated criminal case for helping executives dodge taxes on extravagant perks such as Manhattan apartments and luxury cars. The company was fined $1.6 million. One of the executives, Trump's longtime finance chief, Alan Weisselberg, pleaded guilty and served 5 months in jail. James' lawsuit does not carry the potential of prison time, but could complicate Trump's ability to transact real estate deals and could also stain his legacy as a developer. Also on the front page is an article entitled "Workers Who Weathered Shutdowns Brace for Another." John Hubert, an airport security officer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, recalls helping fellow Transportation Security Administration workers get essentials from food banks when they worked without pay during the last government shutdown. By the end of the 35-day ordeal, he needed the same help himself. Steve Reeves, a union leader for workers at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, went through three government shutdowns while working at FEMA and remembers having to pull money out of his retirement early to make ends meet during that last one in 2018-2019. Jessica LaPointe, a Social Security Administration worker from Madison, Wisconsin, says she had to rely on financial help from friends and family during the 16-day October 2013 shutdown. In anticipation of the next one, she postponed a planned family vacation to Disney World. Across the country, federal workers, still stung by the memories of past government shutdowns, braced for another potential extended closure. "We're continuously putting on the chopping block every year. It's ridiculous," said Hubert, 42, who has worked at TSA for 21 years. "We should not be put in this position every single year, then used as a bargaining chip to get legislation passed." With a Saturday deadline looming for lawmakers to approve more federal spending, a deal that is looking less and less likely, workers familiar with the exercise in Washington gridlock are increasingly worried. Hubert, a leader in the TSA Workers Union within the American Federation of Government Employees, representing 1,400 members in his local, prepared for what now feels like an inevitability, another extended period of work without pay. "Just like other Americans, we've still got to pay our bills, regardless of what's going on with Congress," he said. "Officers with children, single parents, are going to be dramatically affected if a shutdown continues over a long period of time." The White House and congressional Democrats, along with some Republicans, warn that a shutdown could be devastating for people who rely on the government for everyday services, while putting a stop to paychecks for federal workers themselves and undermining America's standing in the world. "There are real consequences to real people in a real way when there is a shutdown, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said at a White House news briefing on Monday. He estimated 50,000 workers just at USDA would be furloughed, affecting not only the workers, but local economies where spending will be constrained. Johnny J. Jones, Secretary Treasurer of the TSA Workers Unit within the AFGE, said even a temporary loss in pay is a massive disruption for government workers who live paycheck to paycheck. People have to pay rent. They have child support payments, he said. Landlords don't care about a shutdown, he said, and bills will always be due. The number one question in our minds is how long is this going to last, Jones said. LaPointe, a mother of four who is also a union leader for 30,000 Social Security workers through AFGE, said a shutdown would be a catastrophe personally. During the 2013 episode, I definitely had to scramble to make sure there was enough money in my bank account, she said. That was a really stressful time. She said she had to ask friends and family for help, with the assurance that she would be paid back by the government eventually. On top of prepping for a shutdown, SSA agency leadership and her labor union are discussing the terms for potential long-term furloughs, looking at 4,700 employees who could be let go throughout the year if there were an 8% cut in funding based on Republicans' current demands, she said. We already have 10,000 less workers since 2010 when baby boomers started to retire, she said. A Partnership for Public Service survey ranks the Social Security Administration last among agencies in the best places to work government-wide index. We don't often feel like it's worth it to be federal employees at the time of a shutdown, LaPointe said. Reeves, the FEMA union president, remembers pulling money out of his thrift savings plan, a retirement and savings plan for federal employees, to stay afloat during the 2018 to 2019 shutdown, which resulted in additional taxes and fees. That affects our home finances for the next couple of years, he said. You pay extra to catch back up. He said that while FEMA workers love helping people and bringing comfort to those in disaster areas, the government gridlock makes their jobs harder. He suggests making pay for members of Congress also stop during shutdowns. If their checks were affected, he said, then it would be a different story. Then there wouldn't be government shutdowns. On page 2, an article entitled Victims of Secret Testing Want Compensation. Army sprayed black housing projects with possible carcinogens. From St. Louis, Ben Phillips' childhood memories include basketball games with friends and neighbors gathering in the summer shade at their St. Louis housing complex. He also remembers watching men in hazmat suits scurry on the roofs of high-rise buildings as a dense material poured into the air. I remember the mist, Phillips, now 73, said. I remember what we thought was smoke rising out of the chimneys. Then there were machines on top of the buildings that were spewing this mist. As Congress considers payments to victims of Cold War-era nuclear contamination in the St. Louis region, people who were targeted for secret government testing from that same time period believe they're due compensation, too. In the 1950s and 1960s, the Army used blowers on top of buildings and in the backs of station wagons to spray a potential carcinogen into the air surrounding a St. Louis housing project where most residents were black. The government contends the zinc-cadmium sulfide sprayed to simulate what would happen in a biological weapons attack was harmless. Phillips and Chester Deans disagree. The men who grew up at the Pruitt-Igoe housing complex are leading the charge, seeking compensation and further health studies that could determine whether the secretive testing contributed to various illnesses or premature deaths that some Pruitt-Igoe residents later suffered. We were experimented on, Phillips said. That was a plan, and it wasn't an accident. The new push comes as federal lawmakers weigh compensation for people claiming harm from other government actions and inactions during the Cold War. The Associated Press reported in July that the government and companies responsible for nuclear bomb production and atomic waste storage sites in and near St. Louis were aware of health risks, spills, and other problems, but often ignored them. Many believe the nuclear waste was responsible for the deaths of loved ones and ongoing health problems. The AP report, part of a collaboration with the Missouri Independent and the nonprofit newsroom Muckrock, examined documents obtained by outside researchers through the Freedom of Information Act. Republican U.S. Senator Josh Hawley introduced legislation soon after the news reports calling for expansion of an existing compensation program for exposure victims. The Senate endorsed the amendment. While the House has yet to vote, Democratic President Joe Biden said last month that he was prepared to help in terms of making sure that those folks are taken care of. Former residents of Pruitt-Igoe say they should be taken care of too. Phillips and Deans, both 75, are co-founders of FACTS, P-H-A-C-T-S, which stands for Pruitt-Igoe Historical Accounting, Compensation, and Truth-Seeking. Their attorney, Elkin Kistner, said it would be, quote, appropriate and necessary, close quote, for Hawley's proposal to be widened to include former Pruitt-Igoe residents. The government released documents in 1994 revealing details about the spraying. St. Louis wasn't alone in being subjected to secretive Cold War-era testing. Similar spraying occurred at almost three dozen other locations. There were other types of secret testing. In a 2017 book, St. Louis sociologist Lisa Martino-Taylor cited documents obtained through a FOIA request to detail how pregnant women in several cities were given doses of radiation iron during prenatal visits to determine how much was absorbed into the blood of the mothers and babies. The government also created radiation fields inside buildings, including a California high school. The area of the testing in St. Louis was described in Army documents as, quote, a densely populated slum district, period, close quote. About three-quarters of the residents were black. We were living in so-called poverty, Dean said. That's why they did it. They have been experimenting on those living on the edge since I've known America. And of course, they could get away with it because they didn't tell anyone. Pruitt-Igoe was built in the 1950s with the promise of a new and better life for lower-income residents. The project failed and was demolished in the 1970s. In national and world news, an article entitled FTC states, sue Amazon. Lawsuit says company abuses its position to inflate online prices. U.S. regulators and 17 states sued Amazon on Tuesday over allegations the e-commerce behemoth abuses its position in the marketplace to inflate prices on and off its platform, overcharge sellers, and stifle competition. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in Amazon's home state of Washington, is the result of a years-long investigation into the company's businesses and one of the most significant legal challenges brought against it in its nearly 30-year history. The Federal Trade Commission and states that joined the lawsuit allege Amazon violates federal and state antitrust laws. They ask the court to issue a permanent injunction that they said would prohibit Amazon from engaging in its unlawful conduct and loosen its monopolistic control to restore competition. The complaint accuses the company of engaging in anti-competitive practices through measures that deter sellers from offering lower prices for products on non-Amazon sites, an argument mirroring allegations made in a separate lawsuit filed last year by the state of California. The lawsuit says Amazon buries listings offered at a lower prices on other sites. At the same time, it charges sellers high fees, forcing merchants to raise their prices on the platform, as well as on other e-commerce sites to keep their products competitive on Amazon. The complaint sets forth detailed allegations noting how Amazon is now exploiting its monopoly power to enrich itself while raising prices and degrading service for the tens of millions of American families who shop on its platform and the hundreds of thousands of businesses that rely on Amazon to reach them, FTC Chairman Lina Khan said in a prepared statement. Seattle-based Amazon said the FTC is, quote, wrong on the facts and the law, close quote, and departed from its role of protecting consumers and competition. The lawsuit also accuses Amazon of degrading customers' experience by replacing relevant search results with paid advertisements, favoring its own brands over other products it knows to be of better quality, and charging heavy fees that force sellers to pay almost half of their revenues to Amazon. According to the anti-monopoly organization Institute for Local Self-Reliance, the cut sellers give to Amazon from their revenue is up from 35% in 2020 and 19% in 2014. The lawsuit also says Amazon compels sellers to use its logistics service, Fulfillment by Amazon, to make their products eligible for Amazon Prime, even though many of them would rather use alternative fulfillment services to get orders to customers. The next article is titled Biden Visits Union Picket Line. Live appearance at an ongoing strike seems to be unprecedented. President Joe Biden grabbed a bullhorn on the picket line Tuesday and urged striking auto workers to stick with it in an unparalleled show of support for organized labor by a modern president. Biden told the United Auto Workers strikers that you deserve the significant raise you need as he stopped in the Detroit area a day ahead of a planned visit by former President Donald Trump, the frontrunner for the Republican nomination in next year's election. No deal, no wheels, workers chanted as Biden arrived at a General Motors parts distribution warehouse, one of several facilities that has been targeted in a widening strike now in its 12th day. No pay, no parts. Despite concerns that a prolonged strike could undermine the economy, particularly in the crucial battleground state of Michigan, the Democratic president encouraged workers to keep fighting for better wages at a time when car companies have seen rising profits. The White House said Biden was the first modern president to visit a picket line, a sign of how far he's willing to go to cultivate union support as he runs for re-election. Lawmakers often appear at strikes to show solidarity with unions, and Biden joined picket lines with casino workers in Las Vegas and auto workers in Kansas City while seeking the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. But sitting presidents, who have to balance the rights of workers with disruption to the economy, supply chains, and other facets of everyday life, have long wanted to stay out of the strike fray. The president spent less than half an hour at the Willow Run Redistribution Center, where he was joined by UAW President Sean Fain. Thank you, Mr. President, for coming to stand up with us in our generation-defining moment, said Fain, who described the union as engaged in a kind of war against corporate greed. We do the heavy lifting. We do the real work, Fain said, not the CEOs. Labor historians said they could not recall an instance when a sitting president joined an ongoing strike, even during the tenures of ardent pro-union presidents such as Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Harry Truman. Theodore Roosevelt invited labor leaders and mine operators to the White House amid a coal strike in 1902, a decision that was seen at the time as a rare embrace of unions as Roosevelt tried to resolve the dispute. In a digest of national and world news, we have an article entitled Bank Settles Over Epstein Allegations. J.P. Morgan Chase agreed Tuesday to pay $75 million to the U.S. Virgin Islands to settle claims that the bank enabled the sex trafficking acts committed by financier Jeffrey Epstein, averting a trial. J.P. Morgan said $55 million of the settlement will go toward local charities that provide assistance to victims of domestic abuse and trafficking and other crimes, as well as to enhance the capabilities of law enforcement. Of that amount, $10 million will be used to provide mental health services for Epstein survivors, according to the Virgin Islands Department of Justice. The Virgin Islands, where Epstein had an estate, sued J.P. Morgan last year, saying its investigation revealed the financial services giant was indispensable to the operation and concealment of the Epstein trafficking enterprises. Next, an article entitled, Charges Dismissed in Police Shooting. A judge dismissed murder and other charges Tuesday against a Philadelphia police officer who shot and killed a driver through a rolled-up driver's side window, agreeing with defense attorneys who said the officer could have feared for his life because he thought the driver had a gun. Police body camera footage showed the driver, 27-year-old Eddie Irizarry, holding a knife near his right leg as police approached his stopped vehicle after a short pursuit. The ruling came after a courtroom packed with police and relatives of Irizarry attending now-fired Officer Mark Dial's preliminary hearing watched about 20 minutes of the video footage. The defense argued Dial acted in self-defense when he fired his weapon August 14. Izari's relatives appeared stunned and distraught by Municipal Judge Wendy Pugh's ruling. They said the police should not fatally shoot someone just because they speed or act irrationally. In the Ukraine war, Russia struck the Black Sea region of Odessa in a drone barrage that damaged a warehouse, charred dozens of trucks, and injured two drivers in a fiery explosion that led to the suspension of the ferry service between Romania and Ukraine, officials said on Tuesday. On the Biden family, Hunter Biden and sued Rudy Giuliani, and another attorney Tuesday, saying they wrongly accessed and shared his personal data after obtaining it from the owner of a Delaware computer repair shop. Republican allies of Donald Trump used the data in attempts to discredit his father, President Joe Biden. Article entitled Capitol Riot. Edward Bedalian of California, who prosecutors say was fixated on arresting Democratic leaders and training for combat with paintball fights after the 2020 presidential election, was sentenced Tuesday to more than 4 years in prison in the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol riot. On school meals, millions of additional students in schools serving low-income communities will be eligible to receive free breakfast and lunch under a rule change announced Tuesday by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. On redistricting, the Supreme Court on Tuesday allowed a new Alabama congressional map to be drawn with greater representation for Black voters. The new districts could help Democrats trying to flip control of the House of Representatives. And from Iraq, a fire that raced through a hall hosting a Christian wedding in northern Iraq's Nineveh province in its Hamdaniya area killed at least 114 people and injured 150 others, authorities said on early Wednesday, warning the death toll could rise. Back to Washington, senators pressure Menendez to quit. Democrats, Booker, demand resignation after his indictment. Senator Bob Menendez came under heavy pressure to resign Tuesday as a surging number of his Democratic colleagues in the Senate, including fellow New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker, urged him to step aside over the federal bribery allegations against him. About half of Senate Democrats have now said Menendez should resign, including several running for re-election next year. Calls for his resignation came in quick succession after Booker called on his colleague to step aside. Menendez refused to leave office, but has not yet said whether he will run for re-election next year. Menendez, the longtime chairman and top Democrat on the powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his wife Nadine, are accused in an indictment released Friday of using his position to aid the authoritarian government of Egypt and to pressure federal prosecutors to drop a case against a friend, among other allegations of corruption. Menendez, who denied wrongdoing, his wife, and two businessmen co-defendants are to be arraigned on Wednesday. Another defendant was arrested on Tuesday. And now from Hollywood, Hollywood writers will end their strike. Actors vote to expand walkout to companies making video games. Leaders of the Screenwriters Union declared their nearly five-month-old strike over on Tuesday after board members approved a contract agreement with studios. The governing boards of the Eastern and Western branches of the Writers Guild of America and their joint negotiating committee all voted to accept the deal and declared the strike would be over and writers would be free to work starting at 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday. Late-night talk shows, the first to go dark when writers walked out on May 2nd, are likely the first shows that will resume. The writers still have to vote to ratify the contract themselves, but lifting the strike will allow them to work during that process, the Guild told members in an email. After Tuesday's board votes, the contracts were released to the writers, who had not yet been given details on the deal, which their leaders called exceptional. The members will vote between October 2 and 9. Hollywood actors remain on strike with no talks yet on the horizon. They voted to authorize their leadership to potentially expand their walkout to include video game makers. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for September 27, 2023 on IRIS, the Iowa Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Gary Lawrence Paulson. Gary Lawrence Paulson, 82, of Mason City, passed away on Saturday, September 23, 2023, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, September 30, 2023, at Wesley United Methodist Church, 1405 South Pennsylvania Avenue, with Pastor Nadine Lunga officiating. The family requests that those attending the funeral dress in casual clothing. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Friday, September 29, 2023, at Major Erickson Funeral Home. Interment will be held at Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to Wesley United Methodist Church or the North Iowa Humane Society, 2700 South Birch Drive, Mason City. Gary was born on July 6, 1941, in Hampton, Iowa, to Lawrence and Ilona Paulson, the oldest of three children. He grew up on the family farm south of Mason City, where he lived and worked up to 2022. He always said that he started farming shortly after birth. Doing the milking in his first year, he attended country school until the age of 14, when he went to Roosevelt Junior High. He graduated from Mason City High School in 1959. In November 1966, a friend introduced him to Sandra Tekipi. They married on August 6, 1967, and had four children. GP loved food, gadgets, John Deere tractors, country music, the old kind, not the new stuff, NASCAR, racing, birding, watching traffic on the avenue, especially the blue light specials, and trains. His dream was to win the lottery so he could buy his own train and drive it all around the USA. He enjoyed chatting with folks and made friends wherever he went. If you weren't friends when he met you, you sure would be when you parted ways. He was a master joke teller and joke collector, most of which aren't fit for print, and had a laugh that the neighbors could hear a mile away. Fall was his favorite time of year because he could spend his days driving his big John Deere tractor around getting the crops out. GP is survived by his wife of more than 56 years, Sandy, children, Stephanie Paulson, Jennifer Thorson, and their son, Nebraska, Stephen Paulson, and his children, Addison Cooper and Maddox, and Brian Paulson and their children, Maverick and Abigail Paulson, Nick Hinton and Logan Campbell, Cat Betsy. He was preceded in death by his father, Lawrence, mother, Ilona, brother, John, sister, Janet Carlson, father and mother-in-law, Bud and Dorothy Tekipi, and grandparents. Mary D. Waite, 94, of Garner, died Wednesday, September 20, 2023, in Forest City. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, September 30, 2023, at St. Boniface Catholic Church in Garner. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to services at the church. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In lieu of flowers, please make a memorial donation to one of your favorite charities or the National Audubon Society. Isabella Morse. A funeral mass will be offered for Isabella Morse at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, September 22, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church. I should say was held on September 22. In Leroy, with Father Maretti Pothiretti officiating. Burial was in St. Patrick's Cemetery in Leroy, Minnesota. Isabel Helen Morse was born on June 22, 1931, in Adams, Minnesota, to Stephen M. and Christina Klapperich. She attended 1 through 8 grades at Sacred Heart School in Adams, Minnesota. She graduated from Adams Public School in 1949. On February 20, 1954, she was united in marriage to Wesley Morse at Sacred Heart Church in Adams, Minnesota. They lived in Austin, Minnesota for over 5 years. In the fall of 1959, they moved to a farm south of Leroy in Howard County, Iowa. After graduation, Isabella worked for 5 years at Schischel Brothers Elevator in Adams, Minnesota, as a bookkeeper and at the Adams Theater. After she married, she worked for 2 years at Meyer Wolf & Sons in Austin, Minnesota, as a bookkeeper. She worked for over 20 years for the Maurer County ASCS office in Austin. Later, she worked for 9 years at Ampride in Leroy as a clerk. She was a hard worker on the farm, helping milk over 100 head of cows at one time. Always had a very large garden and enjoyed working in the yard. She could always be seen in her later years doing yard work. She was also known for her cookies that she made with her grandchildren. She enjoyed cooking and baking for others. Most importantly, she enjoyed spending time with her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her parents, infant daughter, granddaughter, great-granddaughter, 3 brothers, and 1 sister, and her husband Wesley in 1993. She is survived by 1 son, Raymond of Balch Springs, Texas, 3 daughters, Penny, Rick Earl, Mary Morse, both of Riceville, Iowa, and Carrie Anderson of Stuartville, Minnesota. One more story of national news from Seoul, Korea. The U.S. soldier who sprinted into North Korea across the heavily fortified border between the Koreas 2 months ago was released into American custody on Wednesday, according to 2 officials. Earlier, North Korea said it would expel Private Travis King, an announcement that surprised some observers who had expected the North to drag out his detention in the hopes of squeezing concessions from Washington at a time of high tensions between the rivals. King's expulsion almost certainly does not end his troubles or ensure the sort of celebrity homecoming that has accompanied the releases of other detained Americans. And there remain unanswered questions about the episode, including why King went to North Korea in the first place. His fate also remains uncertain, having been declared AWOL by the U.S. government. That can mean punishment by time in military jail, forfeiture of pay, or a dishonorable discharge. King was transferred to American custody in China, according to 1 of the officials. The 2 U.S. officials spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss King's status ahead of an announcement. King, who had served in South Korea, ran into North Korea while on a civilian tour of a border village on July 18, becoming the first American confirmed to be detained in the North in nearly 5 years. At the time he crossed the border, King was supposed to be heading to Fort Bliss, Texas, following his release from prison in South Korea on an assault conviction. On Wednesday, the North's official Korean Central News Agency reported that authorities had finished their questioning of King. It said that he confessed to illegally entering the North because he harbored ill feeling against inhuman maltreatment and racial discrimination within the U.S. Army and was disillusioned about the unequal U.S. society. It has attributed similar comments to King before, and verifying their authenticity is impossible. In an interview last month with the Associated Press, King's mother, Claudine Gates, said her son had reason to want to come home. "I just can't see him ever wanting to just stay in Korea when he has family in America. He has so many reasons to come home," she said. King, who is from Wisconsin, was among about 28,000 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea as deterrence against potential aggression from North Korea. U.S. officials had expressed concern about King's well-being, citing the North's harsh treatment of some American detainees in the past. Unauthorized crossings across the demilitarized zone separating the Koreas are extremely rare. The few Americans who crossed into North Korea in the past include soldiers, missionaries, human rights advocates, or those simply curious about one of the world's most cloistered societies. North Korea's decision to release King after 71 days appears relatively quick by the country's standards, especially considering the tensions between Washington and Pyongyang over the North's growing nuclear weapons and missile program, and the United States expanding military exercises with South Korea. Some had speculated that North Korea might treat King as a propaganda asset or bargaining chip. In the end, the North apparently concluded that King simply wasn't worth keeping, possibly because of the cost of providing him food and accommodation and assigning him guards and translators when he was never to be a meaningful source of U.S. military intelligence, and Chung Seong Chang, an analyst at South Korea's Sejong Institute. Captive Americans have been flown to China previously. In other cases, an envoy has been sent to retrieve them. That happened in 2017 when North Korea deported Otto Warmbier, an American college student who was in a coma at the time of his release and later died. And now a look at sports. From Baltimore, Hall of Fame third baseman Brooks Robinson, whose deft glove work and folksy manner made him one of the most beloved and accomplished athletes in Baltimore history, has died. He was 86. The Orioles announced his death in a joint statement with Robinson's family on Tuesday. The statement did not say how Robinson died. The face of the Orioles for nearly a quarter of a century, Robinson won the heart of the city that adopted the deft-handed kid from Arkansas in 1955 and never let him go. Before Ripken, there was Robinson. Before Cal, there was Brooks. Before the Iron Man, there was the human vacuum cleaner. As Oriole icons, no others come close. Robinson played 23 years in Baltimore, piling up numbers that made him one of the game's greatest third basemen and which put him in the Hall of Fame in 1983. He was the AL's most valuable player in 1964 and the World Series MVP in 1970, when he led the Orioles over the Cincinnati Reds. Then a balding 33-year-old father of four, Robinson thwarted the big red machine game after game, on a national stage with brilliant backhand stabs, off-balance pegs, and timely 429 hitting. "I'd pay to watch him play," Red star Pete Rose marveled. 4 years earlier, Robinson had helped the Orioles win their first world championship. In 1966, they swept the Los Angeles Dodgers in four straight games as Robinson homered in his first at-bat. Fans remembered his joyful leap in the air, captured on film at the series end.
My kids thought it was trick photography, Robinson said. They told me, Dad, you never jumped that high in your life. Robinson hit 268 home runs, played in 18 straight All-Star games, won 16 consecutive Gold Gloves, and set a slew of records for third basemen, including most putouts, assists, double plays, and fielding percentage at .971. In 1999, Robinson was named to Major League Baseball's All-Century team. In 2007, baseball fans named him the best defensive third baseman of all time in balloting conducted by Rawlings. No other position player received as much of the vote, 61%. Modest to a fault, Robinson seemed unfazed by accolades. Accepting his MVP award in 1964, he quipped, I'm still trying to figure out how I hit 28 homers. To the end, Robinson, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1983, seemed perplexed by his inclusion at Cooperstown. Every month I think about going back there to make sure no one takes my plaque off the wall, he said in 2007. There's Ted Williams with a lifetime batting mark of .344, and Joe DiMaggio and Stan Musial. And oh, there's Brooks, who hit .267. How did I get into the Hall of Fame anyway? Pigeon-toed and slow afoot, Robinson made up for it with sure hands, lightning reflexes, and an unerring knack for making acrobatic throws that would nip runners by a whisker. He barehanded bunts with poetic precision. Hitting was another matter. A notorious streak hitter, Robinson carried the club, .295, 17 home runs, for the first half of 1966, and then tailed off at the end, .236, 6 homers. But his fielding never wavered. Watching Brooks play third is like watching Oscar Robertson play basketball every day, teammate Frank Robinson said. With the Ryder Cup competition beginning this weekend, we have an article from Italy. Justin Thomas is too occupied with helping the Americans end 3 decades of losing the Ryder Cup on European soil to worry about any criticism of him being part of that effort. U.S. Captain Zach Johnson had no second thoughts about using one of his 6 wildcard selections on Thomas in a slump so severe that he failed to reach the PGA Tour's postseason for the first time in his career. Neither did the 6 automatic qualifiers or vice captains who had a voice in the selections. Thomas has been an emotional spark in his 2 Ryder Cup appearances, along with a 6-2-1 record in France and Wisconsin. As for anyone else, Thomas says he has a short memory when it comes to criticism. I definitely haven't kept the receipts, he said Tuesday. I don't feel like there's any good that can come from that. When it comes to stuff online, everybody has got an opinion, and theirs is right and everybody else's is wrong. The only thing that mattered to me was that Zach and the vice captains and the other 6 guys wanted me on the team. And now that I'm here, all of us hold the same weight as the other one, he said. We are all one, and it's just our job to go out there and try to win points. That seemed much easier the last time at Whistling Straits, before a one-sided gallery against an aging European team. This version of Team Europe has a core of experience that is heavy at the top. John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, newly crowned FedEx champion Victor Hovland, and a backroom that has years of heritage from players who defected to LIV Golf, but not the template of success. Tuesday was the first full day of practice, with the Americans starting on the back 9 at Marco Simone and the Europeans on the front 9, both facing a tough walk over hills and vales that figures to be taxing in the warmer-than-usual weather. Pairings for the first session are not announced until the opening ceremony Thursday afternoon. But for the Americans, it was obvious even before practice rounds. Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele have been partners since their first President's Cup in 2019, with one exception at Whistling Straits, while Thomas and Jordan Spieth have been friends since they were in their early teens and partners dating to 2018. He just gets the ball in the hole faster than the other guys do. And that's how you win matches here. And that's how you play good golf, Spieth said. I've been beside him for these Ryder Cups, and he quite simply plays better golf than the guys across from him. And in news from the WNBA, Breanna Stewart was honored to win one of the closest MVP races in WNBA history. The New York Liberty star took the WNBA's Most Valuable Player Award for the second time in her career on Tuesday, edging Alyssa Thomas and Aja Wilson. There were only 13 points separating Stewart from second-place finisher Thomas of Connecticut and last year's MVP Wilson of Las Vegas. It's been an unbelievable season for the WNBA. AT and Aja had amazing seasons. It just shows we're reaching new heights, Stewart said. That greatness shines in many different ways. That this race was so tight is kind of crazy, but I'm happy to be standing up here today. Stewart received 446 points, 20 first-place votes, 23 second-place votes, and 17 third-place votes. Thomas had 439 points, and Wilson received 433 points. A lot has changed since Stewart last won the award in 2018. She's married, has a daughter, Ruby, recovered from a ruptured Achilles tendon injury. She also made the difficult choice to leave Seattle and come to New York as a free agent. It's been a roller coaster of a journey, and I wouldn't wish it any other way, Stewart said. To show that resiliency works, no matter the highs and lows, keep pushing forward. With Stewart and Thomas separated by 7 points, this marks the second smallest margin between the first and second place finishers in the history of the award. The closest finish was a 2-point difference between Cheryl Swoopes and Lauren Jackson in 2005. The 13 points separating Stewart and Wilson represent the smallest margin between first and third place vote-getters for MVP in WNBA history, surpassing the 45-point difference in 2013 between Candace Parker and Elena Del Don. It hurt like hell, it really did, Wilson said, of not being named MVP, but it's all part of the game. The 29-year-old Stewart, who won the award in 2018 with the Seattle Storm, made the decision to move closer to home and come to New York as a free agent this past off-season. The move has paid immediate dividends for her and the Liberty. The AP Player of the Year helped the team finish the regular season with the second-best record and was the WNBA's second-leading scorer, averaging a career-best 23 points a game. She scored over 40 points 4 times this season, including 45 in her home debut. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for September 27, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.